Devaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 9, The Passing Away of Bhishma Dev. Text number 48. Tato Yudhisthiro Gatva Saha Krishna Gajavayam Pitaram Sampayam Asa Gandharim Chatapasvinu Tataha. Thereafter, Yudhisthira. Maharaj Yudhisthira, Gatva, going there, Saha, with Krishna, the Lord, Gajavayam, in the capital named Gajavya, Hastinapur, Pitaram, unto his uncle Dhritarashtra. Sandvayam Asa consoled Gandharim, the wife of Dhritarashtra, Cha and Tapasvinim, an ascetic lady. Translation. Thereafter, Maharaj Yudhisthira at once went to his capital, Hastinapur, accompanied by Lord Sri Krishna, and there he consoled his uncle and aunt Gandhari, who was an ascetic. Therefore, Dhritarashtra and Gandhari, the father and mother of Duryodhana and his brothers, were the elder uncle and aunt of Maharaj Yudhisthira. After the battle of Kurukshetra, the celebrated couple, having lost all their sons and grandsons, were under the care of Maharaj Yudhisthira. They were passing their days in great agony over such a heavy loss of life and were practically living the life of ascetics. The death news of Bhishma Dev, uncle of Dhritarashtra, was another great shock for the king and the queen, and therefore they required solace from Maharaj Yudhisthira. Maharaj Yudhisthira was conscious of his duty, and he at once hurried to the spot with Lord Krishna and satisfied the bereaved Dhritarashtra with kind words from both himself and the Lord also. Gandhari was a powerful ascetic. Although she was living the life of a faithful wife and a kind mother, it is said that Gandhari also voluntarily closed her eyes because of the blindness of her husband. A wife's duty is to follow the husband 100%. And Gandhari was so true to her husband that she followed him even in his perpetual blindness. Therefore, in her actions, she was a great ascetic. Besides that, the shock she suffered because of the wholesale killing of her 100 sons and her grandsons also was certainly too much for a woman. But she suffered all this just like an ascetic. Gandhari, although a woman, is no less than Bhishma Dev in character. They are both remarkable personalities in the Mahabharata. Om Agyanati Midandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurubhe Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manovishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Katamayam Darati Swaparantikam Mama Srishta Manumati Sachiputra Matva Sarupam Rupam Tasyagrajam Rupudim Mahpudim Gostavitim Radha Kundagirivara Mahoradi Kamaravasam Praptoya Sapatita Kripaya Sri Gurum Tam Natosmi Tato Yudhisthiro Gatva Saha Krishna Gajavayam Pitaram Sampayam Masa Gandharim Cha Tapasvinim. Thereafter, Maharaj Yudhisthira at once went to his capital, Hastinapur, accompanied by Lord Sri Krishna, and there he consoled his uncle and aunt Gandhari, who was an ascetic. So we're coming to the conclusion of this wonderful chapter in Srimad Bhagavatam entitled The Passing Away of Bhishma Dev. The introduction to the Srimad Bhagavatam from Narada Muni and Drona and his son Ashwatthama, Drona's son punished Ashwatthama, and the prayers of Queen Kunti, and here the passing away of Bhishma Dev, and then we'll hear how the Pandavas wind up their pastimes, and Dhritarashtra quits home. This whole first canto is highlights, you can say, highlights of the Mahabharata. And this is in essence, this is in the ninth canto, we have two chapters on Ramayana. Ramayana, of course, is a very extensive Purana or Itihasa, history of the pastimes and activities of the incarnation of the Lord as Ramchandra. But in the Srimad Bhagavatam, out of the 18,000 verses in Bhagavatam, maybe 100 or so verses are dedicated to Ramayana, to the pastimes and activities of Lord Ram. And the Mahabharata is in various incarnations of Mahabharata, because there's a Mahabharata that we read, and there's a Mahabharata from the heavenly planets, and there's a Mahabharata in different dimensions. There are many hundreds of thousands of verses in Mahabharata. It's composed by the incarnation of the Lord as an author. The Lord has so many incarnations, Lila avatars and different Purusha avatars and different human avatars. And in one of those human avatars, the Lord appears as an author. And as the author of a great text, he is the personification, or he's the epitome of perfection of the literary craft. So any form of embellishment in literature that we might study in relationship to Shakespeare or in relationship to some great traditional historical writer, poet or whatever, Vyasadeva, he continues to top that in his different forms of literary styles or text types. We call them genres. So Shri, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he perfects this art of alankara. Alankara means when you dress up a text to make it look more attractive, to make it sound more attractive. You become more involved and more absorbed in the literary composition when it's embellished. Alankara means to put on the jewellery of the words, of the language, to make it enticing, to make it attractive and to make it accessible. When we hear literature that is very expertly composed, then we can see the pastime. We can imagine that. The language becomes visual. It's a visual aid. The descriptions of Krishna in Vrindavan in the forest, and the description of how Krishna, what he's wearing and what he's doing and what he's thinking, particularly what he's thinking, what is feeling, and these as very expertly portrayed or crafted by Srila Vyasadeva in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the 10th canto particularly. But throughout the whole Srimad Bhagavatam, we have very wonderful descriptions and of different personalities and different pastimes and activities that are teaching us a lesson, that are designed. They're placed, they're very carefully or strategically placed in the Bhagavatam to teach. The Bhagavatam, Prabhupada says, our education should be to the extent of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Vidya Bhagavata Avadi. We can learn everything from Srimad Bhagavatam, from science and technology to history and geography and psychology and sociology and philosophy. There is not a subject matter that the Srimad Bhagavatam doesn't touch upon. And therefore, Prabhupada said, if you want to be learned, if you want to receive a real education, you should be educated according to the extent of Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam is the limit of knowledge. It's the limit of our educational concepts and ideas and experiences. So what do we learn from this? The end of the last sloka, or the second last sloka of this ninth chapter of the first canto of the Bhagavatam. And we started the first canto of the Bhagavatam in the forest, the Naimisharanya forest. Naimishe Nimishakshetri Rishaya Shonakadayaha. The rishis, headed by Shonaka, they were assembled in the forest. And they're asking Suta Goswami pertinent questions. Questions that are going to penetrate, questions that are going to inspire and touch and move the hearers and the listeners. Not just in the forest, 80,000 people that gathered in the forest of Naimisharanya, not just those people, but people, the millions and millions of people that are going to hear Srimad Bhagavatam after the recitation of Shanaka Rishi. So they ask these questions, they want to know, you're Suta Goswami, you're very expert, and you're a learned person, and you've studied the scriptures in great detail, all the Vedic knowledge. Can you tell us for this Kali Yuga, which is an unfortunate time where we have reduced capacity for understanding, we have reduced time for understanding, we have reduced facility for understanding the Vedic literatures. Can you extract for us the essence of the Veda and then give that to us? What will be the most beneficial thing that you can give to us from the Vedic literature? And Suta Goswami, he begins his work on extracting the essence. And his response to Shonaka Rishi and to the sages assembled in Naimisharanya is a response to these questions. Essential teachings. The Upadesha Sada. What is the essential teaching of the Vedic literature? At the conclusion of the Bhagavatam, it says that the essence of the Veda is Bhagavatam. So the whole Bhagavatam is the essence. 18,000 verses. That's concise. Compared to what it was, it's very concise. And it's sequential. You can say it's a scope and sequence of knowledge. And it starts in Mahabharata. It starts with these great personalities. And that's the conclusion. The conclusion is that you've heard the Srimad Bhagavatam, you've got the essence. And so what is the most essential thing for mankind to do in Kali Yuga? This Yuga which is a Manda Sumanda Matyo Manda Bhagyu Padrutaha. A Yuga that's wrought with complications and frustrations and obstacles to developing bhakti. What's the best thing we can do? Savaipung Samparahatama. The best thing you can do is to engage in devotion, to do service to Krishna. That would be your best bet. In the age of Kali, if you can connect with Krishna, then you'll be doing well. Your senses will be controlled, your mind will be controlled, your intellect will become sharp and capable of discrimination. And your soul will be satisfied. Yayatma supersedity. And that's what we need. We need satisfaction of the soul, of the Atma. When the soul is satisfied, then we become peaceful. We develop qualities of the devotee. You know, we have the 26 qualities of the devotee, or many other lists of qualities of the devotees. Those qualities begin to develop when we become self-satisfied. So long as we're hankering after something external, bahimukha, when we're looking for our satisfaction outside the soul, then we're not developing the qualities to the same capacity that we have when we become self-satisfied in our bhakti, in our devotional service. Prabhupada says in the Upanishad that the human form of life is the ultimate, it's the form of life that can experience the maximum capacity of consciousness of all living entities. Of the 8,400,000 species of life, in the human form of life, we have maximum capacity to realize our full potential as a jiva. And whatever that is, whatever percentage it's given, 76% or whatever it is, that's how much we can realize in human form of life. But we can't do that in the tree form of life, we can't do it in the cockroach form, can't do it in the mouse form. But we can do it in the human form by inquiring, by association, by worshipping the deity, by chanting Hare Krishna, by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. We can develop that. Vidya Bhagavata Vaadi. So this literary manifestation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Srimad Bhagavatam, composed by the literary incarnation of the Lord, Srila Vyasadeva, is teaching us to become satisfied. And here, Prabhupada highlights two great personalities. One is Bhishma Dev, and one is Gandhari. They're both great personalities in and of their own right, and for different reasons. Bhishma Dev is called the Vasuttama. He's the greatest of the Vasus. And some of you who have read the Mahabharata, or at least the early chapters of the Mahabharata, you know that there was a great intrigue. And Ganga Devi, she was, all the children that were born, she was killing them, one by one. And till the last one, she saved this one, and that was Bhishma Dev. Became Bhishma, who took this great vow never to get married, so that his father could marry and enjoy it. So Bhishma Dev, he's a personification of a tapasvi himself. He took a great vow, and through this vow, he developed tremendous strength. Bhishma Dev. Dhritarashtra was blind, but he had tremendous strength, and he had a great amount of knowledge as well. And Gandhari, she voluntarily becomes blind, and she developed tremendous strength. So a lesson that we learn from tapasya, from performing some voluntary, from undergoing some voluntary form of hardship or difficulty for a higher purpose, is that we develop resilience in modern terminology, or some tejas, strength, some power to overcome the influence of the material world, to overcome our attraction for the material energy. That's the process of Krishna consciousness, is to identify with these great personalities. Recently we were talking with a devotee who was experiencing some hardship. Sometimes devotees experience hardships. And she was grieving for the loss of a loved one. And it's a difficult time to go through that, the loss of a husband or a wife or a child or a father or mother. This is a difficult time. But we can think, just try to put ourselves in the shoes of these personalities from the Mahabharata. Like Gandhari, she lost 100 children. If we lose one child, it's devastating, right? Or if we lose a husband, it's devastating. But she's lost 100 children and unlimited grandsons and relatives. They've been killed. It's a massacre. And they're performing this Shraddha ceremony after the carnage of the Mahabharata. Then Yudhisthira and the five Pandavas and the priests, Domya and all the elders, they went to light the funeral fires for all the dead soldiers. They're not going to just leave them there for the vultures. They're great personalities, so they take all the dead soldiers, and with mantra, the brahmanas assembled on the bank of the Ganga, and they lit many, many funeral pyres and put all the soldiers. They burnt them, and they took the ashes of different personalities, individual personalities, and they would take the ashes and put them into the Ganga, offer them into the Ganga with prayer for the benefit of the soul. It's said that all the soldiers that were killed on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, they achieved a higher destination because they died in the presence of Krishna. They died in the presence of the Supreme Lord. So they were all elevated. But still, the samskara, the antyeshti samskara is performed. And the ritual is performed by the priests and the brahmanas. And it's said that the brahmanas, they were chanting the Vedic mantras very, very loudly after the battle of Kurukshetra. You can see millions of people are dead. And so they're chanting very loudly to create an auspicious atmosphere. They said you could hardly hear their chanting over the wailing and the crying and the devastation of the wives and the mothers who lost all their children. They had come down to the bank of the Ganga, taken all the babies to all the soldiers to the bank of the Ganga, and they were just completely devastated, right, by this carnage, this scene after the battlefield of Kurukshetra. And as they were they were doing the last rites for Duryodhana, for Dushasan, for all these big demons, right? But in a cultured way, they were still fulfilling their duty. Yudhishthira Maharaj has a duty now to perform this. And Kunti Devi said also, you do the last rites, Antyesti, for your brother Karna. Now that was the first time they found out they had a brother. They thought they knew all their brothers, Yudhishthira and Arjuna and Bhima, Nakul and Sahadev. And she said, you know, especially you should do this Antyeshti for Karna. And then Yudhishthira, they were all, you know, completely shocked that Karna was their brother. And they were thinking, if we would have known that Karna was our brother, this might not have happened. The Mahabharata, the Kurukshetra fought might not have happened if we would have known that Karna was our brother. And so they had Kunti Devi explain to them how Karna became their brother. An older brother. So they're doing Antyeshti for their older brother. So the many, many intriguing, emotion-packed scenarios, experiences, scenes in the narrative of the Mahabharata. It's such a multi-dimensional narrative that it'd be practically impossible to reproduce this Mahabharata. You would have to be the incarnation of God to write this book, to write the Mahabharata, and to weave in this amazing tensions and resolutions in the different scenes and different pastimes and activities. So after the war in the Kurukshetra, Bhima, the Pandavas go to see Gandhari. This is the second time they go to see her. Now they're going to see her after Bhishmadev passed away. Bhishmadev passed away after a long time, after the battle. He was waiting for the sun for the Uttarayana, for the sun to go north. So he was lying on the bed of arrows for 55 days, I think, 50-something days. He was lying there on the bed of arrows. And he was fully conscious. He'd chosen this. And he was choosing the time when he would leave. Because of his tapasya, because of his great austerity, he was able to choose when he would leave his body. So for 55 days he was just waiting patiently for the sun. And he had many attendants, all the sages and sadhus and rishis, and many, many people were looking after him and shielding him from the blazing sun and protecting him from the elements. But he stayed there for 55 days, which is, you know, it's a couple of months he was out there in the elements, you can say. So they had gone back to Hastinapur before that. So there was a bit of coming and going from Hastinapur to Kurukshetra and to the Ganga for different rites and rituals. When they first went to Dhritarashtra and Gandhari, Dhritarashtra, Krishna went with them. Krishna always goes with them. And Krishna and Arjuna, there's a description of them going from Kurukshetra to Hastinapur the first time. And Yudhishthira Maharaj goes on his own chariot, and Arjuna and Krishna come together. Seems like Arjuna and Krishna are always together. And then all the sages and the priests, Domya particularly, he was with them nearly the whole time. The priests and the brahmanas, and everybody went to see Dhritarashtra and Gandhari. And Dhritarashtra, Yudhishthira, he was very, very emotionally upset, disturbed about what happened. That all these children, Dhritarashtra's children, are dead, and all his cousin brothers and all these people are dead. He's very upset, visibly upset, moved, and he was looking on the ground. He couldn't look Dhritarashtra in the face, or Gandhari. And he went before him and he said his name, because they're both blind, or blind and blindfolded, and he said he is Yudhishthira here, and he touched his feet and offered his respects to his Dhritarashtra, his uncle, elder uncle, and Dhritarashtra embraced him. And then Bhima was going before him, and Krishna stopped him, stopped Bhima, and he said, no, don't go. And Krishna has this, of course Krishna is in the heart of all living entities, Antaram Shakti, and he knew what Dhritarashtra was going to do to Bhishma, because Bhishma had taken this horrible, terrible vow, right, to drink the blood of Dushasan and to make sure that Duryodhana didn't come back from the war. And so Dhritarashtra had very negative feelings towards this character, you could say. So he, Krishna manifests this iron form. Duryodhana apparently had a form of bhima, made a form that it probably used it as a punching bag or something. Said it was in his gymnasium. He had an iron form of bhima in his gymnasium. And so Krishna, by his property city, he brought that form there and he placed it in front of Dhritarashtra, and Dhritarashtra embraced this form and he crushed it. The form just went to dust, or to molecular particles, iron particles, on the ground. And Dhritarashtra, he thought he had killed Bhima. He thought Bhima was finished, and Bhima was there, just standing there. And then they revealed what had happened, that this wasn't really Bhima. Bhima's still right next, he's standing right next to him. And then he was remorseful and he started to think that, you know, he shouldn't do like this, that there's a higher purpose behind all this, and that Krishna has a special lesson, a special pastime to teach through this. And then Arjuna offered his respects, and then they went to Gandhari, and Dhritarashtra embraced Arjuna and Nakula and Sahadeva, and then they went to Gandhari, and Gandhari was, she was feeling very, very, she didn't want to forgive. She was feeling too disturbed that what these people, these Pandavas, have mercilessly slaughtered our children. How can we embrace them? How can we live under them? But they've got, now they've got no protection. They're living under the protection of Yudhisthira and the Pandavas. How can we do that? So it said that Gandhari, for the first time, she lifted her blindfold. She was blindfolded her whole life from marriage. She lifted it and she couldn't look at Yudhisthira, but she looked at his toes. She saw his toes and they turned black. Yudhisthira's toes. And then she covered her eyes and she kind of gathered her composure from fully cursing Yudhisthira. And Yudhisthira was very, of course, he's a personification of Dharma. He was very, very dutiful. And he was going to look after Gandhari and Dhritarashtra just like his own mother and father. And he does, in fact, do that. So then after some time they come back out to Kurukshetra and they go to see Bhishmadev. And Bhishmadev is lying there, as we know, in the bed of arrows. And Bhishmadev, he revealed to Krishna his first lesson, and we heard the first lesson in this chapter. The first lesson that Bhishmadev gives him, he gives many, many instructions on morality and vanashram, dharma, and many, many principles of Niti Shastra he gives to the assembly. And again, it's a big assembly. It's not just the Pandavas and Krishna who turned up, but all the rishis and the sages and the brahmanas. So it's a big, big assembly there. And they're all hearing Bhishmadev's final words. And he said the reason why Krishna had Bhishmadev teach this Vanashram and to teach this Niti Shastra and to teach these different lessons was because he was a great devotee, and there might have been more learned personalities in the assembly. Vyasadeva was there, Abhavata Muni, all the great rishis and munis were there. They might be more learned in Vedic knowledge than Bhishmadev. Bhishmadev is a grihastha. No, he's not, but he's from that, you can say, is from the royal family. He's a kshatriya. But this kshatriya, he's teaching this knowledge because he's a devotee of Krishna. And it says, Prabhupada says, he realized it. There's one thing to speak knowledge, and another thing is to speak knowledge that's realized. Vijnana. Jnana and vijnana are two different concepts, two different presentations. And generally you can feel it. When someone's speaking from the head, you can feel it. And it's just all intellectual. It might be nourishing and it might be exciting and enticing and it might be stimulating. But if it's just always from the intellect and it doesn't come into the realm of the emotion or the heart, then you become a little suspicious. Wait a minute, this guy's got a good memory, but does he know what he's talking about? Like there's an iPod app. I was at a conference a few weeks ago, and this person during the break said, "Oh, check this out." And there's an app for this iPod, and it's a cat, and it's like a wild-looking cat. And then whatever you say, the cat repeats. Right? So, and it laughs. You laugh, and the cat laughs exactly the same way you laughed. Right? Everything. So I said to the cat, you know, "Hamsa vasya prabhu," and it said, "Hamsa vasya prabhu." And then I thought, "I'll do a really fast verse." So I did a really fast verse, and it gave a really fast verse back. I thought, "I'll do a really long verse." So I did a long verse and did it back. I thought, "Oh, this cat's a real devotee." Sounds like anything. It's a cat. And so I was really kind of wowed by this app. And I went home and told Mahavan, our son, and he said, "That's old technology. That's like been around for years, that technology. The latest technology is that you have a real conversation with the app, right? And the app gets right into your feelings and emotions, and if you like get on its case, or if you say something rude, it doesn't respond until you say sorry. You've got to say sorry to it, and then it says, 'I was waiting for that.'" So that's a vidyan. No, that's not vidyan. that's still computer technology. But vidyan is something else in the Vedic understanding of knowledge. Nididhyasana means that it's when you... There are four levels of an education. And the first is shravana, to hear what Prabhupada has established. We're hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, we're hearing philosophy, we're hearing about the pastimes and activities of Krishna, we're becoming inspired to serve Krishna, becoming convinced about what we're doing, shravana. And manana means we start to contemplate. We use our mind on it. We put it together. We make connections. We think of similarities and differences with that. We think of all the possibilities and alternatives and things that we could do with this particular knowledge. How does it fit in with my particular worldview? Particularly with where I've come from, what's my conditioning? Because the knowledge will hit each of us individually differently. Because we have different backgrounds, we have a different kind of worldview, you can say. So that's manana, when you start to contemplate and begin to make connections. And then the next level is nididhyasana. And nididhyasana means this knowledge or this concept of these ideas, they become internalized. They become just part of your spontaneous knowledge bank or worldview. Like driving a car. When you first start to drive a car, then especially a manual, you're hopping, you know, and you're all over the place, and you're getting mixed up with the brake and the accelerator and the clutch, and you know, car ends up inside a tree or something like that. That's what happened. We just came from New Govardhan, and they have these people up there called woofers. They're voluntary workers on organic farms. Woofers. They come as voluntary workers on organic farms and leave as prasadam woofers. They have a lot of prasadam there for the woofers, and they love it. They're the first at prasadam every day, like a long line of woofers. And anyway, this woofer, he wasn't a very experienced driver. And he got into this car at the top of the hill, and he started the car, and he hit what he thought he was hitting, the brake, but it was the accelerator. And so the car went really fast into this tree. And then he thought, he kept hitting it, so I was going faster. He thought, "Oh, he's got to stop it." And then he kept pushing the accelerator, going faster and faster down the hill and the car park. And so he jumped out of the car. He thought, "Oh, this car hasn't got any brakes. I'm getting out of here." So he bailed out of the car, and the car went smashed into the tree. And then it ended up down near the pond, down the bottom of the hill. Luckily, he wasn't in the car. But that's driving is a good example of this. You know, you internalize. You start, all right, you work it out. This is the right one's the accelerator, the middle one's the brake, and the left one's the clutch. And then you learn how to get the right tension and whatever. And then after years and years of driving, you can do it, you just do it by feel. That's nididhyasana. You just do it by feel. It's just spontaneous. Okay, it's time to change down gears, blah, blah, blah. You don't even think about it. And then the next thing is shiksha. And this is really important for us to understand. Shiksha means to teach. So what you've internalized, what we've heard and we've thought about and we've put together and we've analyzed and we've put it all back together in pieces and we've evaluated the value of it, we have to teach it. Patam patam. If we teach it, then it becomes, we get a different understanding of it. If we just keep it to ourselves, that's one thing, it's beneficial. But as soon as you teach it, it takes on a different dimension. And therefore, we have a book called Preaching is the Essence. Or a saying in this one, Preaching is the Essence. Because if you tell someone about Krishna, you get more realization about Krishna. You get more understanding about how to present Krishna to others. And it's not always about beating them on the head with the Bhagavad Gita. It's understanding our audience so that we can give them what they need to do, what they need to progress to the next level. In Prabhupada says in a purport in the first canto that that's the art of preaching, is to connect. It said that Sutta Goswami was realized, a self-realized presenter, because he could connect with his audience. So when we understand what our audience need, and we have various audiences. You know? Sometimes we're preaching to an academic audience, sometimes we're preaching to a working audience, a working class audience, sometimes we're preaching to just complete enjoyers, and they have a different need. Sometimes we're preaching to religious people, and there's a different level of preaching. Before I came out here, some Mormons knocked on our door. They're from the Church of the Latter-day Christ. That's what they have on their badge. Elder Krull. He was from Melbourne, actually. This is in Auckland. And he knocked on my door. And my wife was on the way out. Lucky for her. No, she was on the way out and she greeted them. And I thought it was raining. It was pouring rain. I thought, how can I? These guys are on push bikes, right? They do their door-to-door on push bikes. And I'd seen them the day before, and it was raining the day before, and they were crossing the road just outside our house in the rain. I thought, oh, these guys are dedicated. You can pick them a mile away, right? What they look like. And so I said, all right, come in, guys. We were quite busy. I was ready to go, and I said, we've got 5 minutes. So give it to me in 5 minutes. Just cut to the chase. Get me the essence of the Church of the Latter-day Christ. And so I thought they'd come in and like go preaching hardcore and really give it to me. And they asked me, you know, what I'm doing and where I'm going, what's happening in my life. They're asking me all these personal questions. And then I started talking about Mayapur and India and Krishna. And we put the two chairs right in front of our altar. So they just like, right next to Gadagaranga. they didn't say anything about me. They're just sitting right there like this. What's going on up there? And we were having this conversation around the altar. So then they asked me all those questions and I got to speak. And then they asked me questions. They started to find out what I know about the Bible. So they asked me, do you know who Adam and Eve is? And I said, yeah. And then they were like shocked. And he knows Adam and Eve. Oh, this guy's really onto it. And then after that, they asked me, do I know who Christ is? And I said, come on, guys. He's like one of the most historic, famous personalities in history. Of course I know. And then they asked me a few things. I said, look, I was brought up a Catholic. And I know a bit about the Bible, not much, but I know a bit. And I was thinking, like, wow, this guy's really, really cool. He knows a lot. We don't have to work so hard on this guy. And then they told me what their thing is, and I asked them some questions. You know, 5 minutes was up, and packed them up. And they said, okay, when we leave someone's house, we like to, you know, pray together. We can offer a prayer. And I thought, oh, they're going to do the prayer. That's okay. I don't mind. We'll do a prayer with them. Let's hear what the Mormons have to pray. And he says, as the patriarch of the family, we're inviting you to offer the prayer. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. I can offer a prayer. So I told them, look, I'm going to give you the translation. I'm going to pray in Sanskrit, in a different language, but I'll tell you the translation. So I prayed Ishokanashadras about that everything comes from Krishna. Everything comes from God. Everything that's material comes from God, and where his, we have a particular where not proprietors, where the caretakers of this, and that Krishna's complete in himself. So I gave him two verses, and Hare Krishna prayer. I said that we also pray to the Supreme Lord that he engages in his loving service, And then I did the prayer, Shavasya Om Purnamadam, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And they were young guys, right? They were like, must have been 19 years old. They were pretty blown out by the prayer. Like, okay, that's a prayer and a half. They were really like, wow. They're praying to be engaged in the service of the Lord. And that's what they do. So there's commonality there. Sometimes we think we have to, you know, be the ones who win, or we've got better philosophy and we have to prove that we've got better philosophy than them. But most of the time it's better not to get into that and to just experience. Well, I was listening to a lecture yesterday. Prabhupada said that the Catholics and the Muslims, the Christians and the Muslims, they have these churches, and the anger of bhakti that they're doing there is a bona fide anger of bhakti. It's prayer. They're going there to pray. And he said, this is a good thing. They're going there to pray. So let them go there to pray. That's what they're doing. That's their anger of bhakti. Their main thing, you can see, Prabhupada hit it right on the head, is prayer. Anyway, so this is getting back to our Srimad Bhagavatam and the conclusion of this passing away of Bhishma Dev pastime is that Gandhari and Bhishma Dev are glorified here as remarkable Prabhupadas, as remarkable personalities in the Mahabharata. And they're remarkable because of their tapasya, because of their austerity. Gandhari here is called a tapasvini. Tapasvinim. Gandharincha tapasvinim. She's performed this great austerity, and therefore she has tremendous amount of shakti. And Rishabdev taught this to his children, to his sons. He said, if you want to be happy, eternally happy, then you have to perform some tapasya. Tapo divyam putra kayena sattvam. And from this tapasya, you will become satisfied, and you'll get the shakti, the power, to be successful in your lives. In modern day terminology, we talk about resilience, and we talk about self-esteem. We should have good self-esteem, and that will help us to overcome difficult situations. But that the real what we really need to overcome difficult situations and to cope with trauma and to cope with grief and to cope with everything that's going to be dished up to us. Because sometimes when you're grieving, you think nobody in this world has experienced my grief, right? But someone else has experienced it, and someone's experienced it to a notch up and another notch up. And then you read about the personalities, the grief that they experience. And these are devotees of Krishna, like exalted family members of Krishna. Queen Kunti, she experienced maximum amount of grief. And we think, how can Krishna be doing this to us? My father died. My husband died. Everyone's going to die. Not Krishna. Everybody dies. It's time for grieving, but it's not so traumatic that we're not going to overcome that and get on with our lives. And we do. And we do that by the strength and the power of our tapasya. And our tapasya is to engage in the five potent processes of bhakti. By following the five potent processes of bhakti, we develop resiliency. We develop the capacity to overcome setbacks and to push forward in our lives in a progressive way, that we become convinced about what we're doing here in Krishna consciousness. This is a good thing, what we're doing. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, when you act with conviction, you can overcome anarthas. But without conviction, then anarthas, we still tend to safeguard them in a dark corner of the heart. But when we're convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that we're a spirit soul, completely apart from the gross and the material body, then we develop a strong sense of identity, and we can become powerful, we can become empowered and transformed to help others become empowered and transformed. Any questions or comments?
Ranveer and Thank you very much for such enlightening talk. I was wondering if you covered, when you were covering Bhagavatam, sociology, anthropology, science, did you cover mental science?
Yeah.
And aeronautics?
Definitely.
Because Bhagavatam is the source of so many
things. Yeah.
In flying, in satellite, Bhagavatam, writers. The other point was, will I tell something about Loknath Swami today? Loknath Swami is disappearing today. Loknath.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I thought you meant Alokanath Swami first.
You were.
Yeah, no. I can't say off the top of my head, but if you have, please share with us. No. Anybody? Loknath Swami.
Actually, watch his documentary, The Lost Village.
That's another Loknath Swami. We're hoping it's not his. Good question. Tapasya, austerity, is not considered to be an anger of bhakti by Rupa Goswami in the Nectar Devotion. But it's how can we kind of understand a healthy, how do we appreciate a healthy level of austerity that's going to benefit our devotional service? Sometimes the terminology sometimes is, it's used, the same word can be used for different levels of meaning in tapasya. We have an image of a tapasvi, like Gandhari, who's covered her eyes and she's very stoic and very, she's going to bite the bullet and she's going to grin and bear it, and she's like that. That's of a tapasvi, someone who's just doesn't have any feelings left. You know. There's a tendency for one who performs austerity for the heart to harden. That's the reason why Rupa Goswami says it's not an anger of bhakti, because austerity can make you proud and can make the heart harden. And the whole process of bhakti, of devotional service, is to soften the heart. Prabhupada says it nicely in the second canto. He says that the heart is like steel framed. It's concrete and it's steel framed. Sutta Goswami says that in the third chapter, in the change of heart. That if you're chanting and you don't feel any emotion for Krishna, then your heart is like, it's like concrete. So how to soften that? Not by austerity. We soften that by association with devotees, by practice of Krishna consciousness, in a regulated way, according to instruction of authorities. But there has to be some form of... Rishabhai puts it nicely. The qualifier for his tapasya is divyam, tapo divyam, that it's transcendental tapasya. That there's an element of tapasya that's very pleasing to the Lord also. Vairagya vidya nija bhakti yogam. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to teach tapasya in one sense. He came to teach vairagya, detachment. Detachment is also another nuance of the word tapasya and vairagya. Detachment and austerity, they're very similar type of, almost not synonyms, but they've got a different angle. So Lord Chaitanya came to teach that, to teach a form of tapasya that will connect us with Krishna. And that's a simple tapasya that elevates the human beings to, it elevates the living entities to the human platform. That is no meat eating, no gambling, no intoxication, and no illicit sex. That tapasya, that's a form of a tapasya, a detachment. We don't touch those things, and we become we lift ourselves to the human platform. That's vanashram. From the whole Bhagavatam, it said, presupposes that we're on the human platform. David Midimaraj said this at the retreat down in Otaki when I went earlier this year. He said the Bhagavatam begins from the presupposition is that it's speaking to human beings. So the instruction is for humans, not for animals. So by tapasya we come to the human platform, and then on the human platform we have so many interactions and so much engagement for our senses and for the mind and for the intelligence and for the body is unlimited. Spirit soul, when the spirit soul is going to become fully realized, if we're going to realize our full capacity as a jiva, then there's a lot to do. The jiva has a lot of interaction to do through all of the various senses. And that's the transformation of heart is just that. It's using our senses in Krishna's service. Prabhupada says in the Purport in this canto that art and music and technology and science and psychology, and gave a long list in 1.5.22, they're all factually Harikirtan when they're connected with God. When they're connected with Krishna, they become Harikirtan. But if they're not connected, they're mundane. So our purpose, our goal is to connect everything with Krishna and transform it to make it spiritual. So even tapasya, if tapasya is not connected with Krishna, it's mundane and it hardens the heart. If it's connected with Krishna, it's transcendental and it softens the heart, or it enables us to become attracted to Krishna and his service by making garlands and cooking for him and finding out what he likes and dressing him and dancing for him and singing for him and reading for him and understanding for him and associating for him. So connecting all of our sensual activities for Krishna. Prabhupada says Krishna, 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 everything for Krishna, eating for Krishna, working for Krishna, 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 Krishna. He said Krishna consciousness is so simple. Savai Bhagavato Raja Pandaveyo Maharataha. He said that this Purikshit Maharaj, he's a great Raja Rishi. Bhagavata Raja. He's a great Bhagavat and he's a great king at the same time. And he said he became a great personality by Balakrida Krishna Kridam. By in his childhood he used to play like all kids. He's a great king, but he used to play. And what did he play? He played Krishna Krida. He did Krishna pastimes. He reenacted Krishna's pastimes and he became a great devotee. And so Prabhupada concludes this lecture by saying that just by connecting everything with Krishna, we become Krishna's devotees. We become inspired to become devotees of Krishna. So it takes away that kind of esoteric, ethereal, out the otherworldly dimension to Krishna consciousness and brings it into our reality. Okay.
And his mother
was in Radhagopur Nanda's temple. Yes. Gopal Bhattar Goswami. Yes. And he had a daily Radhagopur Nanda to carry the bag of his neck in those days in Jaipur.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you very much for helping us remember that. Radhagopur and then
Radha Gopal and then Radha Gopal. Well, his mother said Radha Gopal and then Radha Gopal. He was Narottam Das Chakravarti. Yes. Our soul is so entrapped in three modes, from life and moments, millions and millions of years. So only by emotional service we can get attachment to Krishna. As you said, only by attachment to Krishna, only by emotional service we can get it.
True. Anantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.